So hey guys, this is Patrick.
And this is Matt.
When we recorded our main episode, about an hour after we were done, the news broke that former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe had been shot while campaigning in Nara, Japan. And this is now a day later. We're recording this on Saturday, July the 9th, and Shinzo Abe is now dead. And that's really, really very shocking, and we wanted to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, totally out of the blue. I mean, I think the big thing to reinforce here is that this wasn't part of any kind of groundswell or trend in society or anything like that. It was just completely out of the blue. It seems to be a lone actor. They're saying now that he was motivated by some sort of anger at an unspecified religious group and attacked Abe as a target of opportunity. But we really don't know, because this is just unfolding so rapidly. And it's also not really an example of gun violence as we think of it in the States, because the weapon seems to have been handmade out of like metal tubes and tape. It's just really, really odd all around.
It's bizarre. We don't have much information. The police arrested Tetsuya Yamagami, a 41-year-old veteran of the Maritime Self-Defense Forces, currently unemployed. It's not really clear what was going on there, but there's footage of the actual assassination that you can see. He's standing about like 9 feet away from behind Abe, and two shotgun blasts at close range, and it's really horrifying. And what's really striking to me is like normally how accessible Japanese politicians are. I mean,
they're just on the street.
They talk in front of the station. They talk in front of the supermarket. They drive trucks around your neighborhood. And I think that's going to change, because this is just, it's crazy. Abe was just standing in the middle of the street, surrounded by people.
One of the comments that I read about this that I think is probably true is that there's going to be a lot less of that kind of openness when it comes to politics and politicians in Japan from now on. And like, there's a lot of things wrong with Japanese politics, but one of the positive sides of it was there was a lot closer of a connection between citizens and politicians, like you're talking about. But, and you know, and I think the fact that this was televised actually plays into that. You know, it's ironic, because the last major political assassination in Japan, which took place in 1960, it was the assassination of the Socialist Party chairman Asanuma Inejiro, and he was famously stabbed on stage with a small samurai sword during a speech, and that was broadcast all over the world, and it was like this huge kind of pre-mass media hysteria moment. And this is kind of echoes that in a lot of ways. That the 1960 incident was like a mentally kind of unstable lone actor. I think that's what's kind of happening here as well. And the way that it's being picked up by the Western media and like online, it's just so interesting to me to see Westerners kind of impress their own, I don't know if prejudices is the word, but their own issues from their own societies and their own kind of fantasies about Japan on this. Like, is it the Yakuza? Is this like an example of why there should be more gun control? Like, no, this isn't really a gun control or gun policy issue at all. It was like a handmade weapon. And it's just, I don't know, it's another kind of mass media happening.
Political violence is pretty rare in Japan, although it does happen from time to time in the post-World War II era. But what makes this one really shocking and kind of shakes the world up is because, you know, Abe is probably like one of the only two former prime ministers of Japan that, you know, people know around the world, him and Koizumi probably. I mean, he was really the face of Japan during his term in office.
Totally. And like, for all of his many, many faults as a politician, I was certainly no supporter of his policies. It is under his watch, so to speak, under his administration, that cool Japan actually started to flourish, which is a sort of connection to what we talk about. He is the one who initiated the launch of the Japan Brand Fund that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, that is struggling now. But it was he who actually put this kind of vague idea that cool Japan or soft power was a thing into actual political practice. So that's a kind of legacy of his that is connected to what we do here.
And I mean, he was kind of a character in a way. I mean, you could buy little like, you know, omiyage, you know, gifts at the station that had little, you know, super deformed characters of him. They sold, you know, Abe rubber masks at Don Quixote. And of course, he was Mario at the Olympics when they had the pre-opening ceremony.
Famously, yes, he dressed as Mario. I mean, he was a very charismatic guy. I wrote about when he hosted Donald Trump here in Japan in 2017. And, you know, he had these hats made that like make Japan, US-Japan alliance great again. And like, they had kind of branded it. And actually, it's interesting because Abe reached out to Trump in the first place through pop culture. Like, he made these like Pico Taro videos, Like, he actually hired Pico Taro to make videos that would appeal to like Ivanka and the people around Trump. And then like he gave a bunch of like Pokemon merchandise to Ivanka. So this was like really a case of diplomacy by pop culture, although like it was not kind of diffuse. It was focused on one family, one kind of political family. But it's also pretty interesting from that standpoint, too.
So the legacy of Abe is really big, but, you know, there are some elements to it that are a bit hawkish and nationalistic. As late as last month, he was calling for Japan to like double defense and like put U.S. nukes on Japanese soil.
Yeah, he was like a really unrepentant militarist and you know, very against making any kind of apologies to neighbors for war crimes or atrocities and things like that, and was rightfully criticized about it because, you know, although Japan has done a lot, a real lot to support local, you know, economies, it was just a bad look. It was really a bad look. And so he didn't make a lot of friends in Asia. He was mainly beloved by, you know, far right leaders abroad. He was a kingmaker. He's certainly like a power broker behind the scenes. There's no question about that. That's why he was out there stumping, you know, like he wasn't some has-been. I don't know that he ever would have been prime minister again, but this could have been one of those situations, I think, where, you know, like the emperor steps down, but like is the regent behind the scenes. I really think that's what was going on here. So it's a very mixed bag as to his legacy. But, you know, regardless of what I feel about the guy personally, nobody deserves to go out like this. And it was just a complete shock to, you know, to me and to, and I think everybody, I kept hearing on the streets, wow, this doesn't really feel like Japan. Like, this happened in Japan, you know, like Japanese people just couldn't wrap their brains around it.
It's shocking and stunning. And again, tomorrow is election day in Japan. So this is maybe the biggest thing that's happened in recent memory in Japan. So we will continue to monitor and report on it. And in the meantime, here's the rest of the episode of Pure Tokyoscope as we originally planned it. I'm Patrick Macias, the author of Tokyoscope.
And I'm Matt Ault, the author of Pure Invention. And together, we are stronger, faster, something. Fill me in here.
We are Pure Tokyoscope, a weekly podcast featuring news and views from the land of the rising fun. Keep the word fun in mind because for the news this week, it's been sort of a bad week for otaku.
This has been a very dark week, a very dark week for Japanese otaku.
The story that kind of like hit me the hardest initially, your mileage may vary, was the death of Teruyoshi Nakano, RIP. He was basically the special effects director at Toho Studios, the home of Godzilla, during the 1970s. It's always a really, really sad thing when a Japanese special effects genius departs us, but what a legacy. So if you have any favorite Godzilla movies that were made during the 1970s, this is the guy. Teruyoshi Nakano was your dude.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's all about Godzilla versus Megalon. It's funny because whenever you say to actual Japanese Godzilla aficionados that you like that movie, they kind of are like, oh, I'm so sorry. You know, it's not really a really beloved film here in Japan. In fact, a lot of people see it as a sort of nightmarish dumbing down of the Godzilla legacy, but I loved it. I loved it as a kid. And it is something that a lot of, you know, tokusatsu films aren't. It's interesting and exciting all the way through. Plus, it has the world's, at least the tokusatsu world's first, you know, alternative lifestyle portrayal with the two daddies, a robot and a kid. I mean, it's kind of a, you know, a genius setup, but it was fun. You know, it was a really fun film. But I mean, he's done tons of stuff.
Nakano started out as an assistant special effects director to Eiji Tsuburaya, god of Godzilla, the father of Japanese special effects. So Nakano was there at the golden age of Japanese special effects at Toho Studios, when I think they had a lot more like time and money and like staff to work on these films. So he worked on some of the big golden age. I think he started on films like King Kong versus Godzilla, Gorath, which is like an amazing science fiction movie with incredible miniatures. So then by the 70s, Eiji Tsuburaya had died and Nakano sort of took over the special effects directorial spot at Toho. And the budgets had gotten a lot lower. They didn't have as much time. And so, you know, I think he kind of had a reputation among Godzilla fans as like not as good as Eiji Tsuburaya. It was like always felt like a step down. And I don't think it was really his fault. I just think it was largely he didn't have the resources that they did in the 1960s.
Well, definitely. I mean, budget determines these things. Animation is kind of the same way, too. So when people are like, oh, my God, that looks kind of cheap. It's like, well, you have to ask yourself, is that really the director's fault or is that the fault of the people who are funding the film? But, you know, this guy is obviously a master at his craft, and working within a budget is a really serious skill for professional, too. I just love there's so many great photos of him from the 70s. You know, he's like giant belt buckle, you know, skin tight at the top, flared out jeans, leather jacket, standing next to Mechagodzilla. You know what I mean? Or like hanging out with Godzilla, and it's like cigarette dangling from his lips, sunglasses on. I mean, this guy is a legitimate hero of the tokusatsu world. And you kind of touched on this earlier, but as these guys pass away, techniques kind of die with them. There's really not a lot of chances to do practical effects on the scale that they did back in the 60s and 70s anymore. What was the last film that really used them? Death Kappa? I'm trying to think.
For as much as people kind of put down Nakano's films for not being as good as they were in the 60s, when Eiji Tsuburaya was riding high, he did have one ace up his sleeve. He loved big explosions, big gunpowder and gasoline explosions. And his nickname was Bomber Nakano at Toho Studios. So you can count on his movies to have like just giant, gorgeous, like porno for pyros. And my personal favorite Teruyoshi Nakano special effects sequence is from Terror of Mechagodzilla in 1975, where Titanosaurus and Mechagodzilla blow up downtown Tokyo. And it looks like your TV is going to blow up. Literally everything just fills up with gasoline and fire. And you can smell it. I love the smell of napalm in the morning. Pretty sure was his mantra.
Didn't he also work on probably jockeying for position as number one of my favorite Godzilla films, Godzilla versus Hedorah, the smog monster? I believe he was the director of special effects on that as well.
He was indeed.
How did they make that film without drugs? That's what I've always wondered.
Pabron Gold S? What do they call it?
They got the Povitan D? Who knew it was psychoactive?
I mean, some of the most iconic, goofy Godzilla moments of all time, Nakano had a hand in. Like in Godzilla versus Hedorah, the smog monster, Godzilla tucks his tail up between his legs and starts flying around the movie screen like a Harrier jet. And also in Godzilla versus Megalon, he does that amazing flying drop kick. Godzilla just jumps up and just goes across the screen horizontal. Non-Godzilla films he worked on include The Submersion of Japan, Nihon Shinbotsu, which is kind of considered one of the great Toho movie special effects highlights. Nostradamus no Daiyogen, Nostradamus' Great Prophecy, which is an amazing film that's been taken out of circulation by Toho.
Why'd they take it out of the rotation? What happened?
It has a scene at the end with some like post-atomic mutants that freaked people out, and it was one of those things where they felt it was insensitive. So it was a big release from Toho, but they withdrew it from circulation, and it's never been officially released on home video in Japan, although it was released in other countries, including the United States and parts of Europe. He was 86 years old, so poor one on the curb today for Teruyoshi Nakano.
Giant against giant. The ultimate battle. Godzilla versus Megalon. Giant against giant in the most spectacular battle yet. You'll see it all in Godzilla versus Megalon. Rated G.
And then I guess we have to talk about the other great passing that was even more of a shock, because this gentleman was a lot younger, at only 60 years old, the creator of Yu-Gi-Oh!, Kazuki Takahashi.
What it says here is that Takahashi was found dead just off the shore of Nago, Okinawa by Japanese coast guards. And at the time of his death, he had been wearing snorkeling gear. It was later confirmed that he had been attacked by a reef shark and died 2 days prior to authorities discovering his body.
So, like, I'm a pretty avid snorkeler, and usually, you know, when people get injured or pass away snorkeling, it's because they, you know, they made a mistake with the snorkel and they inhaled water or something like that. An actual shark attack is unbelievably rare. It makes me wonder if maybe he had a heart attack or something, or drowned and then the sharks came up afterwards, if that's true. That's really wild.
It sounds like they're investigating it just to make sure there's no foul play or anything like that. This kind of reminds me in a way of the passing of Yoshinobu Nishizaki, who was kind of the Gene Roddenberry of Yamato, who also died in the water and under somewhat semi-mysterious circumstances, because these guys apparently are worth a lot of money sometimes.
I was never a huge Yu-Gi-Oh fan myself. You know, it came out kind of in the 90s after I had graduated from Childish Things. You know me, but its influence on pop culture is huge. It was sort of the counterpoint to Pokemon and the other card games out there. Maybe a little bit edgier, a little bit harder. I mean, it was absolutely huge at its peak.
Yeah, I was working at Viz at the time when Shonen Jump USA came out, and they were like going hard with entering the U.S. market with Yu-Gi-Oh! And it was kind of, they'd learned a lot of lessons, the Japanese pop culture industry, after Pokemon, the whole mixed media thing, that this was going to be a collectible card game. It was going to be an anime, a manga, and toys, and God knows what else. And it seems that the card game alone has generated something like $10 billion by itself. This is not counting all the things like Yu-Gi-Oh! Shampoo or those goofy toy card dealers or the cosplay wigs.
This is another kind of only the good die young scenario, because I believe the creator of Crayon Shin-Chan passed away quite some time ago at around the same age in a hiking accident. So it's always sad when these, you know, creators check out so young. It's really a sad kind of day for people into Japanese pop culture.
My personal connection with Yu-Gi-Oh! Is that for some weird reason, when I was working at Viz, they sent me to Tokyo to cover the Yu-Gi-Oh! World Championships for Shonen Jump.
Oh, wow. What was that like?
It was like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, only with a lot of little kids and Yu-Gi-Oh! Cards. It was actually, you know, kind of like melted my cold, cynical heart. You know, I went in there just like, you know, looking for adrenochrome and like, seeing bats everywhere. And there were all these kids from all over the world sitting together at tables. Like, we had kids from Japan, obviously, Italy, Norway, the US. They couldn't even talk to each other, but they were playing Yu-Gi-Oh! And if only we could be more like that, what a wonderful world it would be.
Well, this is the calm before the storm before all these kids graduate into Magic the Gathering, which is, of course, a known gateway for Satanism and alternative lifestyles. So,
I mean, it definitely made a lot of kids greedy. I think there are stories about kids who stole money from their parents to buy Yu-Gi-Oh! Cards who were like never seen again. That's not an urban legend. That probably happened all the time.
They weren't good kids like me. I was only stealing quarters from my parents, like, to go play, you know, Dig Dug. So it's kids these days, man. They've gotten so hard. They've gotten so dangerous. You know, it's to me, it's kind of part of the holy triumvirate of Pokemon, Digimon, and Yu-Gi-Oh, right? You know, it's like you were in one group or another. When you were, I guess, a millennial.
You had to choose a house, like in Harry Potter. So Yu-Gi-Oh! Leaves behind like millions, if not billions, of crazy kids who grew up addicted to the adventures of Yugi and Co. But my favorite thing is the Yu-Gi-Oh! Anti-drug PSA that four kids made back in the day. And I'm going to play it in honor of our fallen mangaka, Kazuki Takahashi.
I know marijuana is harmful. I know it can't improve my game. My friends and I have faced many battles, and we have always dueled without drugs. I wouldn't be the world's best duelist if I smoked marijuana. It would disappoint my friends and lower my concentration. And losing control with drugs is one duel I don't want to have. I must stay healthy and keep my friends close if I want to defeat my opponent's monsters. I will never dishonor myself or my friends by using drugs. That's playing a game I can't win. Honor my anti-drug.
What's cooler, the Yu-Gi-Oh! PSA or the McGruff the Crime Dog?
One to grow on?
When you smoke crack cocaine. That one? No. Okay.
More bad news from Sora News 24. Akihabara landmark Tora no Ana is permanently closing chain downsizes to just one branch in Japan. Matt, can you tell us what Tora no Ana is or was?
So Tora no Ana was this chain of manga shops, and they also, in addition to quote unquote regular / normal manga, they also carried a lot of doujinshi and things like that. Doujinshi. So Tora no Ana was a purveyor of doujinshi, and doujinshi is the Japanese word basically for fanzine. It's a fan-created comic book, and as you probably know if you're listening to this, there is a huge cottage industry in people making their own parodies and homages to famous comic books here in Japan, And those are the fuel for Comic Market, otherwise known as Comic-Con, which is the single biggest fan gathering of any kind on the planet. Before COVID hit, 750,000 people visited the last major pre-pandemic comic market. So, I mean, it's giant. It's like absolutely a huge, huge subculture here. And but, you know, that's only a couple days out of the year. So when you want your doujinshi and there's not an event going on, where do you go? Torino Anna. So, or Mandarake, one of the other places. But Torino Anna was really one of the anchors for that entire culture. And now it is basically a shadow of its former self.
Do you know what percentage of Torino Anna was just an immense sea of porn?
Well, I think to answer that question, you have to ask yourself, what percentage of doujinshi is a sea of porn? And that's like, I think Einstein was working on that around the time when he died. It's like a huge probability matrix having to do with quantum mechanics and stuff.
Yeah, I think the answer was he scrawled it on like a paper napkin and it said a lot.
And published it. That was it. That was accepted at the Journal of Science or whatever publishes such things.
And that was a big store in Akihabara. It was seven floors plus a basement. And it apparently it had been open for 28 years. So it was a real landmark. Like the thought of Akihabara without Torino Anna is quite frankly a bit shocking and depressing. I mean, there's been a lot of closures in Akihabara recently.
They were in a way a sort of competitor to Mandarake, who has also a huge selection of that sort of thing, but they sold mainly new comic books. That was where you went when you wanted to get the hot new releases and things like that. And I know a bunch of people who kind of cycled through there as employees, as clerks over the years. It was kind of the place if you were an otaku, you'd place, I don't know if you'd aspire to work there, but they were always looking for people to work there. And it's not hugely surprising to me that they are disappearing because Japan, like everywhere else, is now a place where when you want the hottest, newest thing, you pre-order it and it's delivered to you at your house. So there's not much of a need to go into Akihabara and buy stuff anymore.
I never really bought anything there, but I would certainly sometimes go and check out like the new releases and you could instantly just walk around and get a sense of like, okay, what are the big hot new things in otaku culture like right now? It was like an immediate finger on the pulse kind of place to go.
Definitely an anchor. It's like when one of those big anchor department stores leaves the shopping mall and then like you go back a couple years later and it's a wasteland like, you know, Dawn of the Dead or something like that. I hope that doesn't happen to Akihabara when a place like this goes out. But, you know, that idea of going somewhere to buy stuff is so, I mean, it's on the wane in Japan, just like it is everywhere else. And this is one of the unfortunate casualties of that shift in consumer purchasing demographics, I think.
So it sounds like after this is going to be only one Torino Anna left in all of Japan, and that's going to be in Ikebukuro, Otome Road.
Are we allowed to go there?
I don't know if we're allowed to go there. So that's like maybe like a girls only boys love kind of place. But
are there like girls standing guard at the entrance to Otome Road, like crossing their spears so that like we can't enter? I hope so. That would be kind of awesome. So that was, it's been kind of a bummer this week for fans of Japanese pop culture, but there is one silver lining. There is one golden shining moment, Patrick. Do you want to be the first one to reveal this? Because it hasn't, I think, been really publicly revealed yet.
GoBots!
They're back, baby. GoBots are back. The Bandai, I don't know what you call them, spin-off company, a child company to their parent company, Mega House, has announced the release of the first in what will hopefully be 6 million characters to follow of the Machine Robo series in Japan, which is the Japanese name for the GoBots in the United States.
Remember the GoBots, Matt?
Everybody, when I was growing up, gave the GoBots shit for not being as cool as the Transformers. But we're here to tell you on Pure Tokyoscope, that's not the case, kids. Actually, they came first. They came first, and the Machine Robo toys were intended to compete with Hot Wheels cars.
Yeah, because they're small. You could put them in your pocket, and you can roll them around and stuff. And you can't really do that with Transformers.
No, and, you know, it didn't really help that while the Transformers were animated by, I don't know, Toei Doga, the greatest animation company in the history of Japan, the GoBots were animated by
Hanna-Barbera, who brought you Fred and Barney and the Shmoo.
It was literally one of those moments as a kid where I was like, oh, wow, my people suck. We suck this bad. You know, because there is no comparing those two shows side by side, man. It's pretty rough. And you don't even have to be a fan of GoBots or Transformers or anything. I'm not talking subjectively. I'm talking objectively. Like, one was the best that Japan had to offer, and the other was the best that my people had to offer. And I was like, wow. I think that was the moment when I was about 8 years old that I was like, shit, I got to move to Japan. I think that was literally it.
You had to get away from Psykill and Leader One and go find Rock Lords on Gobotron.
The names aren't really any better of the GoBots Machine Robo in Japanese. They're like Drill Robo, Bike Robo, Plane Robo, but like they're not gags. I don't even know what you call Fightor. You know, truckster, scooter.
It's almost as if they made these shows for children.
It's like the Tonka people spent all of 5 minutes brainstorming these names for, like, you know, breaking off for their, you know, 3 hour, 15 martini lunch.
So what is the status of Machine Robo, the original GoBots in Japan? Do collectors value them highly? Like, they're bringing them back, so it's obviously something that's got some value to someone. So, I mean, who is the demographic like for this sort of thing?
From a collector's standpoint, they were produced in huge numbers, so I don't really think there was a big market for them until the last couple of years, which, you know, then basically everything old starts to take off. So the initial like 10 or 15 of them have a really strong Japanese toy pedigree. They were designed by the same gentleman who designed most of the Chogokin toys, Katsushi Murakami. So they were kind of his brainchild. And actually, when we met him, you and I, Patrick, many years back, we talked about that. And I remember it coming up in the conversation, you know, why do Americans, like, you know, make fun of the GoBots? Why do they make fun of this? And, we had to kind of tell him about the whole thing with the cartoon. You know, not really. It wasn't about the toys. It's not you, it's them kind of thing.
We had to apologize and bow a lot. And he asked us questions like, did America do the right thing at the end of World War II? This literally happened.
That was a kind of like the conversation veered from, like, he was obsessed with cars. So, like, we're talking about like the Ford Futura, you know, like the Batmobile, which is admittedly a high point in American car design, to suddenly talking about dropping nuclear weapons on civilian populations at the end of the war. And I was like, whoa, exactly. I thought we were going to be talking about Raideen. But it was cool meeting him, and he's still around. And anyway, the bottom line here being that Machine Robo series is kicking off again. I wonder if this isn't driven a bit by, like, how the Transformers toys have been getting, like, so many reissues and, like, you know, renovations. What's the word I'm looking for? Revisitations and getting, you know, and this looks like a moment for Bandai to jump back in. But I know that you and I behind the scenes have been constant boosters for bringing this series back. And I don't know if we had anything to do with it. I'd probably not, but I like to think that we did.
So Machine Robo was not one of those things that every couple of years they would reboot and make new toys. It's really been, like, off the market.
Machine Robo was, like, kind of the Spinal Tap of toys in Japan, because it starts out as this, like, super, you know, hardcore transforming robot line. And then by the end of it, they had kind of made every conceivable vehicle that they possibly could into a transforming robot. And they were so desperate that they're doing, like, transforming rocks. Like Rock Lords, you might remember this. It was literally robots that transformed into rocks. And all of these kind of weird associated kind of, you wouldn't really think of transforming, you know, robot toy lines with this. I don't know. It sort of ran out of steam toward the end in the mid late 80s there. But the takeaway here, Patrick, is not to focus on the Rock Lords. It's to focus on the Machine Robos. They're back, baby. And you know what that means. Japan is back. Japan as a nation is back. It is finally finding its footing once again. It's going to take over the world thanks to this toy line.
So if anyone wants us to do commercials for Machine Robo or GoBots, I'm more than happy to. We certainly have the space available, so I don't have to play these old Top Ramen commercials on our podcast anymore.
Wait a second. Can we get sponsored by Machine Robo? Pure Tokyoscope by Machine Robo.
GoBots! They came by land, by sea, and through the air. Super GoBots. Guardians and renegades prepared for battle. Razor, Spy-Eye, Throttle, and Super Duper. Seeking Vamp, Night Fright, and Clutch.
Fighting robots, by keeping it close. GoBots!
Is it ready?
Super GoBots, each sold separately, new from Tonka.
We now return to the Transformers.
Well, that was episode 8 of Pure Tokyo Scope. Thank you for listening. Thanks a lot. Actually, no, really, it's always a blast to do this. I love sitting here chatting with Patrick, and I love that you love listening to us. So please keep tuning in. Please leave your reviews, and please keep being you.
Thanks so much. We'll see you next week.